Welcome to The Debrief, everybody. We'll take you back to the courtroom for testimony from Markeith Lloyd in just a moment. But first, we now know the name of the police officer who shot and killed a Fort Worth, Texas woman in her own home over the weekend. Officer Aaron Dean was the person wearing this body cam in the overnight hours between Friday and Saturday. A concerned neighbor called a non-emergency police number because the door of a Tatiana Jefferson's home was open. Within seconds of arriving, Officer Dean saw Jefferson through a bedroom window open fire and killed her. He was never attacked. This is the victim of that shooting, Tatiana Jefferson, a pre-med graduate of Xavier University and sold equipment for the pharmaceutical industry. Attorney Lee Merritt set up a GoFundMe page in her honor by mid-afternoon today, Monday. It was about $30,000 away from making a $200,000 goal. The police chief there in Fort Worth called the shooting senseless and expressed sympathy, apologies, condolence, and prayers from his entire department to the family of the victim. Then he demanded action.
We've received many calls from the community expressing their concerns and demands. I assure you, as chief of this department, I share those concerns and I demand a thorough, transparent, and speedy investigation. This will not be an opportunity for us to make excuses, but rather to investigate this case to the fullest, to provide the justice we all seek for Tatiana. The officer who shot Tatiana was served his written administrative complaint on Sunday. At that time, he was also placed on detached duty and stripped of his badge and firearm. My intent was to meet with him today to terminate his employment with the Fort Worth Police Department. However, the officer tendered his resignation this morning before we met. Even though he no longer works for the city, we will continue the administrative investigation as if he did. The case will be completed and reviewed by the chain of command. Had the officer not resigned, I would have fired him for violations of several policies, including our use of force policy, our de-escalation policy, and unprofessional conduct. Additionally, the separation paperwork that is sent to the state licensing agency, the Texas Commission on Law Enforcement, will reflect that he was dishonorably discharged from employment with the Fort Worth Police Department. Despite his resignation, the officer still faces criminal charges from the major case investigation. I personally checked on the progress of that case repeatedly, and I anticipate a substantial update to provide you no later than tomorrow. Additionally, we have also presented a preliminary case to the FBI to review the officer's actions for possible civil rights violations.
Retired LAPD Sergeant Cheryl Dorsey is with us tonight. So Cheryl, the chief there listed a series of swift actions. It might sound to many observers like he's throwing the book at the officer who fired his weapon. What's your assessment?
Well, listen, this was an easy fix because he's a rookie. And so they're absolutely doing a punctious pilot on him. They are washing their hands of him. And I'm glad that they stripped him statewide so he can't go and get on with another agency, at least within the state of Texas.
Should the officer have been fired before he had the chance to resign his position here?
Well, you know, ideally, they probably would have liked to have fired him. But since he beat them to the punch, understanding that because he's not vested, he has no standing. He really doesn't have the support that a tenured officer would have. And so he just did what they were going to do to him before they did it to him.
Should the officer have been, we talked about that for a second here. The chief said that the only time he would consider it safe to fire into a dwelling is if an officer was being fired upon from within the dwelling and the officer knew only one person was inside. Do you agree with that?
Well, listen, absolutely. Anytime an officer discharges their weapon, it's only in the immediate defense of life, And so there was no imminent threat. He was on the outside. And even if he thought he was going to be able, Aaron Dean, to say he perceived a threat, he would not be able to reasonably articulate that because he was outside. He had the ability to take cover and concealment. He could have given orders. He could have stood down and requested a backup. There were all sorts of options that he had available. We're taught and trained to use deadly force as a last resort. We are only allowed to use that force necessary to overcome resistance or in the immediate defense of life. And neither one of those things applied.
I want to go back to that body cam footage because we slowed it down there. I want to look at it again. It shows the officer pointing his flashlight inside the victim's window and she looks out at him. You can see it clearly in the footage. He never identifies himself as a police officer. He just tells her to put her hands up while aiming a blinding light in her face, and then he pulls the trigger just seconds later. It was 2 seconds after he said, put your hands up, put your hands up. Then she's shot and killed. How is that in any way acceptable?
Well, it's not, and that's why he's no longer on the police force, because listen, is it unreasonable to expect at 2 o'clock in the morning that maybe the residents might be contained within that dwelling? But if sense were common, everyone would have it, and you can't teach it. Unfortunately, this woman lost her life, and there's an 8-year-old now who is forever changed because he witnessed her losing her life.
The body cam footage that police have released shows at least one weapon on the floor of the bedroom. If the officer saw that, would that have sent some kind of a trigger off in his mind that maybe he was in danger, or is this just another completely unreasonable fact that's been injected into this?
People are allowed to have weapons in the home to defend themselves. And so the mere existence of a weapon, even him seeing it, she hadn't picked it up. It wasn't in her hand. She wasn't producing it in a threatening manner. And so none of that mattered after the fact. And we don't even know if he saw it because he acted so quickly. And so while that was, you know, nice to know, I don't even know why they explained that there was a weapon found in the house, but to kind of muck up the waters.
It's another fact that's been dropped into the investigation. It's been characterized by many people just as you characterized it. Cheryl Dorsey, appreciate your insight on this case with us tonight. Now let's move on to the case of a Florida man accused of murdering his pregnant ex-girlfriend. Court just wrapped up for the day in the trial of Markeith Lloyd. He's accused of killing 24-year-old Sade Dixon. The medical examiner says Dixon was shot 8 times. He shot and injured her brother, Ronald Stewart. And after a massive manhunt, rather, Lloyd is accused of shooting and killing a police officer. But many of the details of that second shooting are not allowed into this trial. He says the shootings were self-defense, but because the victim pointed a gun at him. Now, despite a history of outbursts in court, the defendant took the stand and started complaining about the victim.
We was in front of her mom's house one time, and she wanted me to smoke with her. So I'm like, all right, I'll smoke one time with you. Because I don't smoke. So we smoke. And then I guess the weed today, when I was young, because I went away when I was 22. So I don't know about all these crazy name weeds, but the weed today is too strong to me. So I was in the car, I smoked with her, and it had my whole body hurting. So I'm like, oh my God, my whole body was hurt. I'm like, Sade, you got this. I thought it was a sign from God, because if we just doing this to a grown person, what you think is doing to a fetus that's trying to develop a brain? And I know weed has cleared some of my memory from my years as a youth smoking weed. So I know as a child trying to develop a brain, what it's doing to a fetus.
Does this testimony somehow help? Sade was not the only woman Lloyd was dating when he found out that the victim, Sade, was pregnant. Another woman was arrested for helping Lloyd flee from police. Those charges were later dropped, and he talked about that.
So I was going to stay with her to 6 months. So when I sent her home at 6 months, she's not going to be able to get an abortion then. So I was going to give her 6 months. So I had talked to one of my exes who I was in a relationship with. And I left her because we had a situation dealing with me and her relationship where she got the mental issue.
The woman that you're talking about is one of the women that were arrested and charged.
Yes.
In this case.
Yes.
It was locked up and 3 weeks.
Yes.
And then the charges were dropped.
Yes.
Okay.
So.
What's her name?
Jimmy Slaughter.
Okay, we left off last Friday with the surviving victim in this case, Ronald Stewart. On cross-examination, Lloyd's attorneys pressed Stewart about when he walked out of his house to see his sister, the victim, arguing with the defendant who you just saw. Lloyd apparently told that witness that Sade was smoking weed and sleeping with other men.
She calmed down from what I seen from the window pane. Yeah, she was looking pretty tense.
And you kept trying to say, separate, separate. You guys, come on, separate. But no one's listening to you.
Well, I told Sade to start walking to the house, and she started doing that, and Marquise was like, no, we're talking about this today.
She got angry, did she not?
She got upset, yes.
And as a result of that anger, she said, my brother will whip your...
Yes.
That's what her response was.
Yes.
She wasn't backing down. She was angry. And you're trying to defuse. Isn't that true?
Yes.
She never mentioned to you that she had asked Marquise to come to the side of the house while she was in possession of that gun.
I didn't hear about that.
She never mentioned to you anything about him telling her to drop the gun.
No.
The victim's mother was at home when she heard the gunshots. She says she walked outside with her other son, Dominique, to see the defendant leave in his car while Sade and Ronald bled on the ground.
She was laying face down with her face looking up at the door on her chest. Okay. So we had to flip her over.
Okay. And was anyone taking care of your son?
Between me and Dominique, no, I kept yelling, my baby, my baby, my baby, Ron, Ron, Ron. And he was grunting. At least we knew we got some type of grunt from him, but Sade wasn't responding at all. So that's when I checked her pulse, and that's when I told Dominique we need to start CPR.
You had training in CPR?
Yes.
Dominique had training in CPR?
Well, Dominique is a certified lifeguard, and so is Ronald. So all of us are trained as certified CPRs.
The victim's mother did admit the family had a gun inside the house. And on cross, the defense asked her about the age difference between the defendant and Sade and about wanting justice.
I called him a 40-year-old...
Anything else?
Pedophile.
So you called Mr. Lloyd, who is 40 years old, dating your 24-year-old daughter, a pedophile. Is that right?
That is correct.
And that was at the beginning. That's how you began your relationship with him.
That is correct.
And you didn't want him in your house.
That is correct.
But you actually allowed him in your house for Thanksgiving.
Only because she asked me.
Because she loved him. In her own way. Is that right?
I wouldn't say it was love. I would say more of lust. But she asked for permission. Mommy, I want to bring him over for Thanksgiving to eat.
So you believe that the relationship was based entirely in lust. Is that right?
That is correct.
Marquise Lloyd is accused of leading police on a massive manhunt and then shooting and killing a police officer when that manhunt ended. Evidence that the officer died is not allowed in this trial, but some evidence of Marquise Lloyd's interactions with that officer is allowed. Here, a witness describes approaching the officer and telling the officer that a wanted man, Lloyd, was in a Walmart.
When I was at customer service, I noticed her walk out of the store. I left out of the store, and when I got past the door, I ran and stopped the police officer. I stopped her and let her know that Marquise Lloyd was in the store. I told her that they were looking for him because he was wanted for murdering Sade Dixon. And then I screamed and told her that he had on a shirt with security on it. She stopped him when he came out.
What did you hear her say?
Get on the ground.
Did the defendant get on the ground?
No, sir. Pushed his cart, ran around a pillar. He came back from behind the pillar, a gun in his hand.
Did you notice whether or not the officer had the gun, her gun in her hand?
Yes, sir. I got on the ground. Shots back and forth.
You know how many shots you heard?
No, sir, I don't remember.
Another witness at the Walmart store where the officer was shot and killed described the defendant's actions.
I heard the officer yelling. It got my attention. I looked. I seen Marquise Lloyd try to run around the pillar, and it kind of looked like he was trying to run from her, but when he figured out that he wasn't going to be able to get around her, he pulled out his gun and started shooting.
And did you see the officer?
Yes, sir.
Did the officer have a gun out?
Yes, sir.
And did you hear her fire?
Yes, sir.
You know how many gunshots you heard?
Not exactly.
After the shooting was all over, what did the man in the black shirt, what did he do?
Ran away.
Let's bring in our other guests tonight, attorneys Chad Young and Michael Bryant. So, Michael, I got to ask about this split between the two cases with the officer and Sade. It seems to me that some legal decision must have been made here that, well, there's evidence of his flight being evidence of consciousness of guilt as to the first shooting, but we're not going to let in too much about the shooting of the officer because that would be unduly prejudicial. Is that your assessment?
Dicey, yes. In a dicey situation that may be the subject of appeal if it becomes an issue, because I don't know how you pair it out like they did. You know, you can talk about him fleeing and evading arrest, but do you have to get into the nuts and bolts of him pulling a gun or the officer having a gun and shots being fired? I don't know if you need to go that far without prejudicing the jury on this thing.
Yeah, I mean it's a really tough line to draw here. Chad, let me ask you about this. The defendant takes a stand, and we were hoping to bring you some of it live here, but he wrapped up just a few seconds into the top of the hour here. But this nonstop testimony about who's smoking marijuana, I'm smoking weed, people are smoking weed, it's going to harm the fetus. How does this help this guy beat a murder charge?
Look, he has to convince this jury what was going through his mind at the moment that he pulled that trigger. And I think what he successfully did today was let the jury know how his mind works, that he is a reasonable guy, he is a loving guy, he always tries to do what is the less aggregated fact. And so I think he really did a good job of letting people know that's how his mind works.
So he's trying to say that she was smoking weed, Michael, and that she's the one that was somehow messed up and that she unreasonably pulled a gun on him. That's where he's going with it?
Well, he's making it sound like this is irritating to me. I've told her many, many times, stop doing that. You're hurting this fetus, my fetus. I'm going to take care of this child. You have to take care of the child while it's in utero. That's the least you need to do. So it helps the jury understand why he was so aggravated.
We're arguing it more articulately than he did, though, Chad. Is the jury getting this? He's coming back on the stand tomorrow. Are they getting this core message?
I think so. Look, many, many times he has said some crazy things, some outlandish things, maybe even some offensive things, especially to some of the female jurors. But I think what you get overall is how this guy processes information.
I think that we've got the message, and there are many interpretations thereof. We'll be back with you gentlemen in just a minute. Still ahead tonight here on The Debrief, two trials. We're following now our questions of death or life in prison. We'll recap those, plus the case of a doctor murdered with a hammer. We will be right back with that case. The jury will begin deliberating in the morning, the penalty phase of the case involving the murder of a Florida law professor. Sigfredo Garcia and Catherine McBonnell were accused of killing Dan Markell. The state said the motive was Markell's divorce and custody battle with his ex-wife, Wendy Adelson. McBonnell's case ended in a hung jury. Garcia's jury is determining a punishment of death or life in prison after convicting him. A third defendant, Luis Rivera, admitted guilt and cooperated with the state. The jury of the so-called Hollywood Ripper is also deciding whether it's life in prison or the death sentence for a man prosecutors say attacked 11 women. Michael Gargiulo stands convicted of killing two in California and trying to kill a third by attacking her in her own home. Gargiulo's son pleaded with the jury to let the defendant, seen here, live. Day three of testimony in the case of a Florida doctor beaten to death with a hammer. Dr. Teresa Severs did not show up to work back in 2015. A friend checked on her at home and discovered her cold, bludgeoned body and the alleged murder weapon nearby. Months later, police charged her husband and two other men with plotting to kill her. Investigators say husband Mark Severs hired his longtime friend from Missouri, Curtis Wright, and Wright's friend Jimmy Rogers to kill the wife. Rogers is the one on trial right now. Wright struck a deal with prosecutors and is expected to testify against Rogers. Severs will go on trial after this case wraps up. The defendant worked on the cleanup crew for a contracting company. Around the time of the shooting, his supervisor says he requested some time off.
He said that he was going to go to Florida to meet up with his brother, who had recently graduated law school, and they were going to celebrate the fact that he had graduated law school.
At some point during the weekend of the 28th, did you have some contact with Mr. Rogers?
Yes, sir, I did.
And what was the purpose of contacting with him?
I hadn't realized that he was still out of town. I had contacted him on Sunday evening to let him know that I didn't need him to work at Doe Run the following Monday, which would have been the next day. but that we needed him to work as a laborer with the roofing crews for our company.
And did you get a response when you contacted him? Did he respond?
Yes, sir, he did.
What was his response?
His response was, I'm still in Florida.
A crime scene technician returned to the stand today to testify about a rental car. She discussed processing evidence from the car, including finding evidence of presumptive blood.
I spent multiple days doing it, but not one after the next.
Okay. And how long was the vehicle in the possession of the Lee County Sheriff's Office?
It is still in possession of the Lee County Sheriff's Office.
Now, this was a rental vehicle?
Yes.
And it was processed approximately. The processing began approximately 3 weeks after the events on Jarvis Road.
There was additional processing by another crime scene technician before I started processing the vehicle.
And that was the processing that was done in Arizona?
Correct, yes.
Do you know how many times during that period of time this car had been rented?
I do not.
Do you know where this car traveled to between the date on Jarvis Road, June 19th, and the day that you took possession of it?
I do not.
Okay, let's bring Michael and Chad back in for analysis on this one. Chad, it seems to me like with the point of this case that we're at right now, is prosecutors just slowly building up some circumstantial evidence. It's going to make a lot more sense once we get into this a little bit further.
Yeah, I mean, that's what you have to do, is sort of lay all the foundations so that you can bring it all together in your summation.
So, Michael, you know, we've got the rental car, we got presumptive blood. Presumably, we're going to get some DNA tests. We're going to get a little bit more out of that rental car. We're going to figure out what he was doing. Was he really in Florida attending a law school celebratory graduation? If the answers are no, it doesn't look good for this defendant.
Yeah, you're right. And there's a lot to GPS information. Remember, it was a trek of about 1,100 plus miles from the defendant's home to the crime scene and back, and the rental car had 2,400 plus miles on it. All of that made sense. All of that's going to lead the jury to think that they got the right guy.
Yeah, I mean, and talk about a convoluted story. You've got the friend and then the friend's friend. When you line it all up, it's easy now to look at it, but police had to do a lot of this legwork to try to make this case make sense. Appreciate the input from both of you gentlemen here on The Debrief. A reminder that the Markeith Lloyd case is actually on a break right now. They're going to be back for more live testimony with the defendant on the stand. If you'd like to keep watching, go to our website, lawandcrime.com. We'll have it for you there. See you tomorrow.